House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Thursday, April 30th, 2009, and I want to announce that on the 7th, we will not have a meeting on May 7th. It's the Police Memorial Day, and those of you who might want to go over to the DPSST to do that, I'll be driving. I'll take a few people with me. We want to carpool. First item on the agenda, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 562.
Senate Bill 562 modifies and clarifies membership and duties of the Oregon Law Commission. It adds two members from the judiciary to the commission. It increases commission terms from 2 years to 4 years. It provides that the Senate and House appointments must be for one current legislator and one member who can be a current or former legislator. It allows legislators who aren't commission members to receive expenses for commission work groups. It clarifies legislative council's role in providing drafting assistance, and it allows the commission to set the meeting schedule instead of having to meet quarterly. The commission was established in 1997, and this is the first time its enabling statutes have been changed.
Okay, thank you. Jeff Dubbins, Wendy Johnson, Elaine Shirley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, pleased to be back with you again today. It's been a while. Here today in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, what you have before you in this bill, as counsel very ably summarized, is an amendment to the enabling statute that created the Law Commission back in 1997. There's nothing too dramatic about it. It's just a fact that after 12 years of operation, naturally the commission has evolved in practice time to really make sure that our enabling statute is in harmony with current practices. Not that we are doing anything extra legal at this point. It's just that it's not kept up with the evolution of the commission and the role of the commission. And so this is brought to you just for that very purpose. I think council did a good job in summarizing the main points of it to add two additional court members, the chief judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals and a circuit court judge, and to clarify that of the two members appointed by the Speaker of the House and the two members appointed by the Senate President, that one would be a current member and one would be at least a current or former member. We think it's important, and we've seen in years past, to have current members on the commission actually serving in the legislature. It helps to communicate the bills and the process of the law commission to the legislature to have that liaison membership. Right now, we have one member, Floyd Prezansky, Senator Prezansky, in the Senate is a member of the commission, but he's the only current legislator who's a member of the commission. So it would make that a fact of membership. And then adjustment of the terms so that they really work better with the flow of legislative sessions. Otherwise, it's mostly in terms of terminology, changing the words committee to work group, which is the term that the commission uses in its drafting committees. I think for any other details, I'd be happy to turn it over to... and also, I should say, just to cover now the role of legislative council, which has changed a little bit since 1997 when the Law Commission was created. Since now, we contract with Willamette University for provision of services that legislative council used to provide. That contract still comes through legislative council. Just is designed to capture those things that have evolved over the past 12 years in the way the business of the commission is done. I'd be happy to answer questions, but maybe you want to hear from Jeff Dobbins, who's the executive director, and Wendy Johnson, who's the deputy director and general counsel for the commission. They're here as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Collins, Executive Director of the Oregon Law Commission and an Assistant Professor of Law at Willamette. It's been my privilege over the last 18 months to serve as Executive Director of the Commission, stepping into the shoes of David Kanegi, who'd been the Executive Director of the Commission in the years prior to that. The substantive bills that are before you today, as well as this particular bill, are all very good examples of the kind of contribution that the Law Commission can make to the work of the state and the Legislative Assembly. And I just wanted to emphasize a couple of points in looking at this bill, which is intended to really sort of streamline the work of the Law Commission and to bring it, as former Representative Shetterly mentioned, into accordance with the way that the Law Commission works today. The success of the Law Commission has really been due to three different types of contributions. The contribution by the state of a relatively small amount, $200,000 every biennium, that provides a portion of the salaries to the full-time staff members of the Law Commission. That state support might not do a lot by itself, but fortunately it's leveraged through two other things, which is the contribution of Willamette University College of Law and the work of all of the volunteers who do work on the commission as well as the work groups of the commission. Since 2000, Willamette University has been the home of the Law Commission through a contract with the state. As Mr. Shetterly pointed out, Willamette matches that state contribution, provides the amounts that are necessary to bring those staff members up to full-time FTEs. It provides the cost of student assistance, research costs, office supplies, computers, office space. You haven't been over to visit the recently renovated Salem Public Library across the street here. We'd invite you to come by and take a look. We've got a beautiful hearing room that's set up for the work of the commission. And these are costs that really make it possible for the Law Commission staff to manage, and that this bill would help really enhance. And then finally, over the course of the last biennium, we calculated that there's been about $2,000 of volunteer work, highly sort of qualified professional volunteers that have done a huge amount of work on the work groups of the commission as well as the work of the commissioners themselves. And all of these things, I think, are going to be substantially improved by the changes that are being proposed in Senate Bill 562. Those particular changes, I think, will help ensure that this that the small state contribution continues to be well leveraged by Willamette, by the work of the volunteers, and hopefully ultimately complying with the goals of the commission, which are to sort of make the state's legal system work smarter and to make those responsible for the laws of the state, the courts, the governor, and the Legislative Assembly look better. So we urge the committee to support the bill.
Members of the committee, Chair Barker. My name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel. I'm here to play cleanup, basically, and take you through the section by section of the bill as appropriate. Council has already summarized the bill well. Perhaps that's necessary. It's the pleasure of the chair. Would you like me to go through the bill, or?
Yeah, Representative Martin.
Chair, I have two questions, if I may.
Yes,
first, to Mr. Shetterly and then to Professor Dobbins. First question, Mr. Shetterly. Let's assume this bill were enacted. The speaker currently has two appointments. I believe it is you and Greg McPherson.
That's correct.
Presumably, then one of you two would have to give up your spot. I didn't see that explained in statute. Would you be leaving? Would Mr. McPherson be leaving? How would that be the speaker's prerogative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton. I think there's a slight extension of the terms upon the adoption of the bill. But you are correct. When the next vacancy comes up, the speaker would be in a position, if they were to appoint a current member then and a former member. I guess that does come down to me or Representative McPherson. Both of us being gentlemen about it, we probably would flip a coin or draw straws or let the speaker do that, and he may choose somebody else entirely. I mean, we are always up for appointment or non-appointment every 2 years anyway. So one of us would not continue in the commission after the expiration of our current terms. That, of course, I would regret that if it was me. I would regret it if it was Representative McPherson. Having said that, I think for the structure and purpose and efficacy of the commission in doing the business that it's chartered to do, it's still for the best.
Which leads me to my follow-up question.
Please.
Specifically, Professor Dobbins, I suppose if that unfortunate happened, because Lord knows Mr. McPherson and Mr. Shetterly are superbly qualified for it, there's a good chance that one of those people would be on this committee here. And do you really want that?
Chair Barker, Representative Barden, I would more than welcome the participation.
You know better, too.
I think it would work very well.
So. Mr. Chair, if I can, just on that, speaking of members on the committee, I think in the early days, there was a period of time we had probably four members of the commission at one point who were legislative members, and it was really great to have their participation in the respective judiciary committees. They've been on the work groups, or if they hadn't been on the work groups, they'd at least been to the commission meetings and had the background themselves on the bills. And you know as members that that kind of background knowledge to the bills that come before you is just that much better to have and serves the committees as well.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson, I think we've had a chance to review the bills. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Johnson that you might want her to clarify anything? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Elaine, good to see you. We saw each other in a similar capacity not too long ago. And my question is related to that.
Yep.
What impact does the current budget conversation infer, to the extent it's relevant for folks in the committee, in the current, even the 5% cut level, the Oregon Law Commission takes a significant cut, maybe everything. Mm-hmm. In the its state funding is eliminated even in the 5% cut level. So right now, the conversation in Ways and Means is that, you know, Do we take just a smaller portion of the 5% cut level? Do we move it down to the 15% cut level? But then what do we put up to the top? I mean, if you're in the 5% cut level, that's a pretty bad place to be. How does this impact that? Is there any connection? How does that impact this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, good question. And I will say, and I think I'm right, that they're really separate. I mean, the impact on the work of the commission based on the budget scenarios that you've described, would be the same under our current enabling statutes as they would be under this bill. This bill doesn't increase the cost of the commission.
Yeah.
So in that respect, I think we need to look at them separately. This is a good bill to do because it's an appropriate adjustment to the structure of the commission and the mission. And we hope that through the good work of the Ways and Means Committee and folks who are talking to the Ways and Means Committee, that money will be found sufficient to continue the commission. If it's not, I think the outcome will be the same with or without this bill. I don't see this bill as being connected to the budget discussion.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Stigler.
Yeah, and I don't care who answers this. I know that this extends, under the proposal, extends a term from 2 years to 4 years, and both the statute and the proposal indicate that the member is subject to reappointment. I don't see that there's a limitation on the number of reappointments. Many boards and commissions, state boards and commissions, have a terminus to their ability of reappointment, and I'm not reading that that's in either of these. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Steele, that's correct.
So they could be reappointed and reappointed and reappointed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Steele, that's how I've been the chair of the commission since 1997, frankly. Recognizing that, we have also had regular turnover in the membership of the commission, I think just as you have in the legislature without term limits. I believe that I am the only member of the commission that goes back to the first commission, and through the bar, through the legislative appointment process, through the governor's appointment process, through the re-election of our ex officio members, the Attorney General and the Chief Justice, we've had a good degree of turnover so far, just by luck, I suppose. It seems to have worked out to a pretty good combination of continuity plus new blood.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up, please.
And you're going to have to educate me here because I don't know what the legislative history was. I mean, I know in general what it was, but behind, I mean, most, as I indicated in my experience, the vast majority of boards and commissions that are legislatively created have a terminus as to times you can be reappointed or not. So what was the logic behind not putting a terminal amount, to the reappointment capacity?
I don't know, and I should. I was on the committee, this committee that passed the bill that created the commission in 1997. I think the sense, if I could just again speak from my own experience with it, is that combination of continuity, which is important in terms of institutional knowledge and experience, along with that natural turnover and infusion of new blood, seems to do the trick. Now, whether that was, I don't think, if you went back to the legislative history, I don't think you'd find that expressly stated, but I think that was the, if I could reimagine what the conversation would have been, it would have been around that.
And if I may, Chair and Representative Stigler, one of the things that's happened as a matter of course is I know, for instance, the bar appointees, often the Board of Governors of the bar expresses a preference that people switch out in appointment processes. There's sort of a natural replacement process that comes through the changing of deans and through the natural election process. And we have been in a period of relative stability as far as re-elections, but it may very well be that will change. And certainly over the course of the last couple of years, we've had a fair amount of turnover as well.
Final thought? This isn't a criticism at all. It's just, and I would see the logic to a two-year, since it's a two-year, to sort of not having any kind of finality to the reappointments. But now we're extending it to a four-year term. And so I guess then that's really leading me to my conclusion is this is obviously a bill that came from the Oregon Law Commission. Was there any discussion up to this proposal that you would have a four-year, you're extending the term of the appointment. Was there any discussion about, ending that at either like a two-year or a two-time reappointment, so like reappointed it, to a second term kind of thing? Was there any discussion around a terminal?
Chair Barker, Representative Stigler, for the legislative members, with this amendment, one member would have to be a member of the legislature. So because your terms are only 2 years, if there's that change, that's an ex officio spot. The speaker would have to make a change at that point. And so we made that clear that
extends all members' terms to 4 years. It's not just the legislative. So
The change from 2 years to 4 years was a very conscious decision because it's only one interim in one session, which many of our projects take two of those sessions or at least partial of a session and another. And as you know, on the legislative side, the speaker changes relatively often, and that's the choice of the Speaker and the Senate President.
My question isn't regarding the 2 to the 4 years. My question is regarding the reappointment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stigler, I think, again, I don't recall any explicit conversation about that, and I think if I could characterize it, it probably falls into the rubric of ain't broke, don't fix. That very same thing that we've had a degree of continuity, but we've also had substantial turnover in the commission, and that just seems to work very well for the purpose of the commission. And so, frankly, I think it was not something that would have occurred to us as a problem to address in an amendment to the bill. To the statute, please.
And if I might, Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, I think the fact that we were going from a two-year to a four-year term represents the main concern of the work group that was working on this, which is that, as Ms. Johnson points out, a lot of our projects will often either extend over the course of two biennia or actually will require cleanup in a second biennium, that having sort of that institutional memory was a very valuable part, and having the very quick turnover was actually a disadvantage to the work of the commission. I think in light of that, the fact seemed to, at least the members of the work group, that there was enough and, in fact, maybe too much turnover. And so I think, as Representative Shetterly pointed out, that was part of the issue, was that there wasn't really a focus on the question of a term limit to appointments.
No comment.
Please. Sure.
I don't necessarily see there as a problem here, but I think, oftentimes, at least going back through the various things I'm familiar with, the rationale, I think, behind having sort of that terminal, you can be, like, for the four-year ones in particular, you're talking about an eight-year period of time, and though continuity is wonderful, I know that the reappointment process can become a very political thing. And if you have members who express a desire to continue to be reappointed, it can become a tricky thing for the appointing entity to not reappoint. And sometimes I think that's harder than takes us off into a side road. So,
just a closing comment on that, perhaps. Then, Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler. Again, I going back to the history of it, it's not been a problem. I know the bar, as Wendy said, has been assiduous in rotating their members, and in fact have rejected requests to be reappointed because it's their practice not to. Out of the Speaker's and Senate President's office, there's been regular turnover there. And again, the deans, they change from time to time or appoint different designees to come. So it's just one of those things that has not been a problem in this commission.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetterly, maybe you can answer the question. It's line 30 on the Senate Bill 5. Who is the current person that's appointed by the governor's office serving in the committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, that person is currently Hardy Myers, former attorney general. He was previously an ex officio member, and the governor appointed him in place of our esteemed Hans Lindy, who previously had been the governor's appointee.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Then, and Mr. Dobbins, you can chip in on this one, too. Of the history of the commission, has it always been consistent, then, that the members that participate in it have a law degree?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, yes.
There's nothing in there that specifically addresses
that. Let me amend my answer. I'm sure there was a period of time. I forgot. We did have a non-lawyer, Senator Vicki Walker, for a period of time served on the commission.
Court reporter.
Pardon?
She's a court reporter.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think maybe it's time for him to need a cop on there.
You nominated Representative Creamer?
That's duly noted.
And you would be speaking on 558 as well.
Why don't we just? I'm at your pleasure. I'm okay.
Why don't we just close the public hearing on Senate Bill 562 and open Senate Bill 558?
Senate Bill 558 conforms Oregon law to changes in Articles 1 and 7 of the Uniform Commercial Code. The Uniform Commercial Code. I'm hearing the lawyers. That's wrong.
I'm sorry for this long. Go ahead. That's okay.
The rewrites are by the OLC.
Okay.
Approved by the OLC.
Thank you.
The Uniform Commercial Code is a model national code to govern commercial transactions. The National Commission has recommended these changes. They reflect evolving business and technological advancements. Briefly, there are changes to ORS Chapter 71, which are general provisions. They modernize terminology. They update concepts for judges to use in resolving disputes. The changes to ORS Chapter 77 relating to documents of title modernize rules for shipment and storage of goods to allow for electronic possession of those goods, whereas now you need the paper title. You have Oregon Law Professor Bier ready to testify, who's on the National Commission, and he can answer any of your questions. This came from an Oregon Law Commission work group, and they reviewed the recommendations and recommended their adoption in Oregon.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Shetterly, why don't you identify yourself and start
again? Sure. Thank you. For the record again, Lane Shetterly, Chair of the Oregon Law Commission, and actually in a dual capacity on this bill, because I also am a member of the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws with Professor Bier, and it is the national conference that promulgated the Uniform Commercial Code and periodically amends it to update it to keep it modern and in touch. And Representative Olson, this bill may be one of the reasons you might not want to be chairman of the Oregon Law Commission. briefly, as counsel said, the National Commission did adopt changes to Articles 1 and 7 of the Uniform Commercial Code. Under the way the Uniform Law Commission works, when the changes are adopted by the Uniform Commission, they are recommended to the states for adoption, and it is up to the commissioners in each state to bring those changes forward for adoption in their respective states. Going back to the bill we were just talking about, the enabling statute for the Oregon Law Commission actually directs that one of the things the Law Commission should do is review acts that are developed by the National Conference and recommend them for adoption in Oregon. This is a textbook case of that. This bill, these acts came out of the National Conference. Oregon Law Commission took a look at them. You can imagine that national acts need some adjustment to fit in with each state's code. There are occasionally policy choices to be made in adopting the national acts. And so the Law Commission formed a work group that included practitioners involved in the commercial code, and we even found a non-lawyer but a trucker who's a representative of the Trucking Association who deals in bills of lading and warehousing that's governed by Article 7 of the code. We couldn't find any lawyers who practiced in Article 7. And that work group went through this update and brought it before you today. It is substantially the Uniform Act with just a few changes made to conform to style and and Oregon law, but it's been adopted. Article 1, I think, has been adopted in 35 states. Article 7 has been adopted in 31 states. So, frankly, we're a little bit behind the curve on this one, and I'm pleased to have the chance to get us caught up on these articles so that we will be more uniform in our version of the Uniform Commercial Code. And now, for your CLE credits, those of you who may not have paid attention during commercial law class in law school, you're going to have a chance for a little bit of a refresher here with Professor Bier, who is not only a member of the commission but teaches this at the University of Oregon.
Poor guy.
Thank you, Lena.
Why would you?
Actually, sure. We all have our quirks, and I actually think the Uniform Commercial Code is very interesting. But I am sharply aware that not all people agree. I don't want to cause too many bad memories for the lawyers on the committee who are remembering their bar review courses, let alone the rest of the members of the committee, so I'll be brief as possible. The Uniform Commercial Code is a technical statute. It's a quite involved statute. It is truly uniform. It's been adopted by all 50 states with the purpose of knitting together the national economy and enabling people to transact ordinary business deals across borders without being...
Excuse me, you need to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, excuse me, Carl Bier, University of Oregon School of Law.
Thank you.
Prior to the Uniform Commercial Code, there was not as much cross-border activity. This is 50 years ago, and in a truly national economy, the paramount goal of the statute is to assure parties across the country that they won't be wandering into legal regimes they're not familiar with just because they're transacting business with somebody that's across a state border. And the code governs a number of patterns of transaction. Some of you know Article 2 is about the sale of goods, sale of ordinary personal property. Article 9 is about secured transactions, which is to say lending backed up by collateral. And Article 7 is less well known. I'll talk about one aspect of it in a moment. It's regarding documents of title, which are things like bills of lading and warehouse receipts. Article 1 is the chief subject of the amendments in SB 558. Article 1 is not a substantive provision, but an umbrella provision. Coming first in the UCC, it provides principles and definitions that are applicable throughout all the rest of the provisions, so that a provision in Article 1 affects sales of goods and secure transactions, et cetera, et cetera. The bill makes three principal amendments to Article 1. I've outlined them in the commission report that you have, and I'll just briefly mention a couple of those. One is course of performance. Course of performance is a tool for contract interpretation. It basically recognizes that the words that parties agree to in a contract might not be completely determinative of a question that might later arise. And courts and parties need to interpret those words sometime. And one valuable source of that interpretation is how the parties have behaved. If it's a long-term contract and repeated opportunities for one side to offer goods and the other side to pay, repeated opportunities for one side to offer collateral and the other side to lend, et cetera, et cetera. Those patterns sort of generate an understanding of what the otherwise less than clear particular words mean. And what we're doing in the bill is taking that course of performance provision, which always applied to sales of goods, we're moving it into Article 1, this umbrella provision of Article 1, so that it will explicitly extend into other patterns of transaction as well. It stands to reason that it's the same kind of common sense utility of course of performance should apply regardless of the nature of the transaction. The second amendment to Article 1 is regarding good faith. Good faith is also a tool of contract interpretation. It's a well-established concept in the common law and also the UCC that when a person signs a contract, they don't just agree to the particular words that are on the page, but to a general commitment to carry out the purpose of the contract. It's not possible for parties to draft foresightfully about every little contingency that could arise years down the road, and so we resort to general concepts of purpose and, you know, common goals, and that's what the duty of good faith is all about. The bill amends the definition of good faith in Article 1 to provide that it includes the concept of reasonable standards of fair dealing in the trade. I'm sorry, the precise phrase is observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealing.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, can you tell me what page you're on?
Actually, page 4 of the commission report. If you're looking at the bill.
Yes, please.
Let's see.
If convenient, otherwise we can.
No. Leon, if you'd like to find it, that would be great.
Sorry to interrupt. I'll find it, don't worry. Please continue.
Okay, maybe we can come back though.
Chair, he probably doesn't understand that he will read that tonight before bed. So he wants to understand all of it.
My job.
I'm grateful for the attention.
That's why I don't have any friends, Mr. Chair.
Let me see. If I may take a moment, Mr. Chair, Representative Spartan, I would like to pinpoint that. It's Section 8, Parent 2, Parent T of the bill. And we can dig out the page.
Yeah.
You have that? It's the definition of good faith.
Yes, thank you. That would be page 5, line 32, if anyone else is following. Thank you.
Article 1, as I say, contains general provisions that apply throughout the code, and one of those provisions is this generalized duty of good faith. What we're doing by making this amendment in Article 1 is bringing Article 1 into conformity with the other provisions of the code, the substantive articles of the code, which in a number of spots in Articles 2 through 9 have their own definitions of good faith for particular provisions, not this generalized duty that you acquire when signing a contract, but particular substantive issues that are governed. And those, little by little over the years, as we've kept the code up to date, have been amended to include the standard of fair dealing. And so Article 1 is bringing Article 1 into harmony with that. Let me see. The report goes on to talk about the statute of frauds provision. With your permission, I'll skip over that just in the interest of time, though I'd be happy to take questions. And the last principal subject that the report addresses is the Article 7 provision. Article 7, as I say, is about documents of title, which are instruments that represent the right to receive goods. There are two principal situations where they're involved in commercial transactions. Large quantities of goods that are stored in a warehouse. I think a good example is grain that would be stored in a commercial silo. And quantities of goods that are kept with shippers for transportation. I think of timber or other crops that are loaded into railroad cars or trucks or whatever it might be. And the warehouses or the shippers issue these documents of title that show who's entitled to reacquire possession of the goods. And these documents, in turn, become representations of the goods. They become subjects of buying and selling and lending and other kinds of transactions in their own right. They represent the goods, and they're convenient ways of doing business. What the changes in the bill would do to Article 7 is to recognize electronic forms of these documents of title so that these electronic equivalents of the documents could be bought and sold in modern frameworks and across larger distances and in shorter periods of time and so on than we can do today. There are a number of complex provisions that are dealt with by the substance of Article 7, but we're not changing any of those principles in this bill. We're really just recognizing the progress that commerce has made in carrying out these transactions in electronic ways. So those are the substantive articles, as Representative Shetterly mentioned. There has already been widespread adoption throughout the U.S. We expect other states to follow suit soon. And in closing, I'd just like to mention the official comments to the national version of the Act. These are carefully written and important explanations of some of the particular provisions of the statute. The Oregon Law Commission Work Group paid a lot of attention to these in formulating its version of the bill, and we hope this body will also pay attention to them. That concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question going back to the change in the definition of good faith that you highlighted for me on page 5, line 19. I recognize we're making the change to keep it in conformity with uniform rules. Are we making a substantive change by doing so? It's not apparent to me that we are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, you mean a substantive change to the statute rather than just to the definition?
To the law. Is that change that we're making in this bill, or this proposed change?
Is it the case that by changing the definition of the term, it would carry through with a modest substantive change to the substantive outcomes where the rule of good faith is applied?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, if I may, because right now, at least in Article 1, definition of good faith is just honesty in the conduct of the transaction. So you can be honest but have terrible and unreasonable business practices that lead to an outcome and still be deemed in good faith. So it sounds, and so we are making a change, that good faith means not only being honest, but also being reasonable in the way you conduct your the dealings. It is a change, but it's not as big a change even as it may seem, because other articles have also defined good faith for particular purposes. Article 2, Article 3, for instance, Article 9. And those articles have already been amended, even in Oregon, to be what the proposed amendment is in this bill. So in some respects, our Article 1, our Chapter 71, is out of sync with some of the specific articles of the code. And so this really harmonizes our own statute with itself so that we have one standard of good faith that applies across the board.
Thank you, Professor and Lane, once again. And we'll go ahead and I think let's open a public hearing and do all work sessions at once. Open a public hearing, close the public hearing on House Bill 558. Senate Bill 558, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 561.
Yes. Senate Bill 561 creates statutory guidelines for deciding which state's laws apply in torts involving more than one state. This is quite a significant work product, also from the Oregon Law Commission. It creates brand new law codifying what laws would apply in Oregon when conflicts of law arise in torts cases. An example would be if two Oregonians are involved in a car crash in Washington. That refers to the conflict of law because a judge has to decide should Washington law or Oregon law apply for damages, defenses, and a whole array of issues. And currently the case law is very puzzling. And so under the leadership of Dean Simeonides, the Oregon Law Commission has attempted to codify Oregon law. If passed, this would be only the second state to do this. And you have the dean and others here to give you more explanation of this.
Please come on up.
Thank you. And you can go in either order again. Just please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, council has aptly summarized the purpose of the bill. I simply wanted to stress here that this bill, Mr. Chair, Jeff Dobbins, Executive Director of the Law Commission, is a great example of the value of the Law Commission bringing to bear on a particular problem of law the considered evaluation of people from a variety of different areas to really focus on these problems. So under the dean's leadership, along with the participation of other public and private attorneys, as well as judges ranging from Professor Lindy and former Supreme Court Justice, Judge Landau from the Court of Appeals, Judge Wilson from the Multnomah County Circuit Court, they've assembled this proposal for the codification of the law, conflict of laws, that would improve the consistency and reliability of the law and the predictability of the law, and hopefully in doing that, save litigation costs, hopefully reduce the the amount of litigation and really increase the efficiency of judges in the legal process generally in the state. We're particularly lucky, I think, to have Dean Simeonides be involved in this project. He's been a strong supporter of the commission at Willamette University, and he is an internationally renowned scholar on this issue of conflicts of law and has worked on this area of codification in the past, not only in other states, but also here in Oregon. We're very lucky, I think, to have him be a part of this project. So with that, unless there's questions, I'll turn it over to the dean.
Thank you, Jeff. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Simeon Simeonidis, and I'll give you a few seconds, maybe minutes, to get used to my accent. I am here in my capacity as one of the drafters of this bill that is before you, which, as you have heard, will codify the law of conflict of laws for tort cases and other cases involving non-contractual claims. This is the second phase of a project to provide some certainty and predictability for our courts in this area of the law. The first phase of the project was a statute, a bill we drafted again under the auspices of the Oregon Law Commission in 2001, which was unanimously approved by both houses of the state legislature and has been in effect since January 2002, and it has been working beautifully. This is one more example of the state of Oregon taking the lead where other states hesitate or are lost. In fact, Oregon has always been pioneering in this area of the law. In 1964, the Oregon Supreme Court was only the second court in the country to break away from the old system which required inexorably the application of the law of the place of injury to any and every tort. That system proved inadequate to handle the complex cases that became more frequent with the increased mobility of people and goods. And so Oregon was among the first to search for a new way. Since then, a lot of other state Supreme Courts have followed suit in a phenomenon that is known in the literature as the American Choice of Law Revolution. And by today, 42 jurisdictions of the United States have abandoned the old rule of applying the law of the place of the injury. And the problem is that they have not replaced that rule with any predictable method. Instead, they have adopted a series of very malleable choice of law approaches which allow anybody to argue that anything goes. So the result of that has been a great deal of unpredictability, in fact, anarchy. One astute observer of the Oregon conflicts landscape has characterized our case law as puzzling, extraordinarily undisciplined, and bewildering. And indeed, bewilderment is the common sentiment among lawyers who contemplate or seek to avoid litigation, because it's difficult, if not impossible, to predict the outcome of a choice of law dispute. So we have too much flexibility, which may be as bad as no flexibility at all, because too much flexibility increases litigation costs, wastes judicial resources, and raises the possibility of what we call judicial subjectivism, the judge doing what appears to be the right thing but without any principles. Dissimilar handling of similar cases and a great deal of uncertainty. So Oregon again takes the lead in showing that there is a different way, and this different way is represented by this bill, which provides specific rules. Basically, we take the courts by the hand, and we tell them what to do depending on the particular pattern that the case presents. So this bill will provide a great deal of predictability, but also while also allowing some flexibility, because we recognize that there may be some unusual or extraordinary cases that may not fit into these rules, we have what we call safety valves, escape devices here and there. But the major accomplishment of this bill, I think, is that it does provide predictability for the cases that are more likely to come before an Oregon court. If I can give you a very brief overview of the whole bill, basically you can divide it into three parts. The first part gives you all the definitions and all defines all the concepts that are used in the bill. Then the second part takes or lists the cases that should be governed by the law of Oregon, regardless of any other factors. You know, for example, if the parties agree to the application of Oregon law, that's the end of it. If they fail to raise the issue of the applicability of a foreign law, then the court applies Oregon law. If they raise the issue but they fail to assist the court in proving the content of the arguably applicable foreign law, then again the court may apply Oregon law. If the action is one against the state of Oregon or another public body of the state of Oregon, then Oregon law governs, unless an appropriate official waives that if the foreign law is more beneficial. If it's an action against the owners or possessors of real property situated in Oregon, then Oregon law will govern. If it's an action arising between an employer and an employee, primarily employed in Oregon, then Oregon law governs. If it's an action for a professional malpractice arising from services rendered entirely in Oregon by personnel licensed to render those services in Oregon, then Oregon law governs. If it's a product liability case, and Oregon has a certain number of contacts, you know, the injured person is domiciled here or the product was acquired here and so on, then Oregon law governs, although there are two exceptions that may be invoked by each party. Even if the bill had only done only this much, that would have been a major accomplishment, because these are cases that come before Oregon courts quite often. But in any event, that leaves all the rest of the cases where Oregon doesn't have these particular contacts. And there again, we take cases and categorize them into patterns. And we draw all of these from the experience of both the Oregon courts and courts in the rest of the country. It has been my misfortune, I guess, for other reasons to I was required to read all the choice of law cases that come out every year for the last 23 years. And doing it as a service to the other professors of conflict of laws, and we publish it every year and so on. Well, one advantage of that experience is that I think I am in a position to know what the courts are doing in the rest of the country. And we took the results of those cases and put them into patterns. This is the benefit we get in drafting the Oregon bill. So, for example, if the tortfeasor and the victim are both domiciled in the same state or in different states which have a law that produces the same outcome, you know, then we apply the law of that state even if the conduct and injury occurred in another state. If they are not domiciled in states that have in the same state or states that have the same law, then we look at where the conduct that caused the injury occurred, where the injury occurred, if they are both in the same state, and that is also the state in which either the victim or the tortfeasor is domiciled, then we say apply the law of that state. If you don't have this pattern, and the conduct, the injury still occur in the same state, and the parties are from different states and so on, you apply the law of the place of conduct and injury subject to an exception. If none of this happens and the conduct is in one state and the injury is in another state, cross-border torts, then again we provide a solution for that. Okay, so this is generally the heart of the bill, taking all of these cases one by one. So the court really knows what the applicable law will be almost from the very beginning of the case, as soon as the basic facts are uncovered. More importantly, perhaps, litigants, lawyers, the parties themselves and their attorneys will be in a much better position to know what the outcome of the case will be, and that will be an important factor in their decision as to whether to pursue litigation or to negotiate a settlement. So we believe that this bill will be very beneficial for the profession and the judiciary. It will conserve judicial resources as well as the resources of the litigants. So this is a very brief overview of a fairly complex subject, but I'll be glad to try to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have, if I may, two, I suppose, big picture questions that I would like to ask, and it's best that we do so on the record. And then also, I have a number of fairly technical questions that perhaps I needn't burden the committee's time with. If we could, perhaps I could meet with Dean Simonides later.
Thank you.
But before, I'd like to preface my comments by noting that Justice Hans Lindy is with us in the front row today. For those of you who, even non-lawyers, might know the name Justice Lindy, he's without question the greatest legal mind in Oregon history. And indeed, although his opinions, truly, he's blushing now, but his opinions...
What are you trying to butter up to?
I know, he's not even a constituent.
Hello, yeah.
Chair.
Leave him alone.
No, truly, his opinion... Actually, and it's funny, I was just thinking, when I was reading this last night, I was thinking of Fazal Ali and how, if we're not making a more substantive change here, we might... But anyway, if it's... My question now,
didn't
if I may.
Did you say that about the Chief Justice last week?
Yeah, that's right. And every constituent who comes to my office. I suppose threshold question is, what is the need of the statute? It is my, I understand it's objective. However, if I'm not mistaken, Oregon largely follows the restatement, as does Washington and many other jurisdictions. By to the extent we're diverging from that, are we not actually making our choice in laws analysis more complicated?
That's a very good question, Representative Barton, Mr. Chairman. You say we follow the restatement. Sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. When we do follow it, sometimes we follow the wrong section of the restatement. Even if we follow the right section of the restatement, very often the restatement doesn't tell you really what to do. It simply gives you a list of factors under which you'll decide. You know, it all is anchored on Section 6, which gives you about 11 factors that the court will consider. The restatement, second, does have a few presumptive rules, but very often courts involve avoid even those rules and go to the more general section. So to say that we follow the restatement, even if true, or to say that a state follows the restatement, really doesn't mean much. It doesn't mean that they follow any particular method. It's just more of a general philosophy. So this bill will provide far more certainty. In fact, you know, under the restatement, there is really no certainty. And the debate now in the American Law Institute, of which I'm a member, is to draft a third conflicts restatement, because we recognize that the second restatement, while it was helpful in the time it was drafted back in the 60s during the revolution, in the beginning of the early days of the revolution, it now is really not very helpful at all. Might as well not have any restatement. So even the American Law Institute is now beginning to recognize that there is a need for more guidance for the courts, and we believe that this particular bill will provide that guidance.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I'm genuinely nervous. First of all, I concededly, I am no expert in conflict of laws, unlike the dean. But I want to make sure that we do indeed have a problem before we attempt to solve it. And I, particularly if a third restatement is coming, I'm concerned any time this legislature attempts to essentially preempt the common law, particularly if there's not a significant issue. So I'm cautious. And then if my second question, threshold question, is this applies in the definitions on page 1 to non-contractual claims. I think that what we're talking about are torts. However, do you mean something by non-contractual claims other than torts? Is it torts plus something else that makes a non-contractual?
Yes.
What is a non-contractual claim?
I'll come to that. First, regarding what is broken. What is broken is that we have nothing right now. Everything is broken. Secondly, regarding a third restatement, if that happens, it will take a long time. And if I'm still alive, I will be very involved in that restatement. At least this is the rumor that goes around. And if that happens, then I bet you then the restatement will follow Oregon's lead, which is very appropriate and poetic. Now, with regard to the non-contractual claim, we, as you will see in Section 1, Subsection 5, we make a cross-reference to ORS 3260, which uses a broader definition again. You are correct. A non-contractual claim includes a tort, but it also encompasses some other similar claims that do not arise from a contractual relation. For example, unjust enrichment, you know,
I see.
And so on.
I see.
So it is a broader, and what we did in the previous statute that was enacted some years ago, we provided rules for what law governs contracts. This will provide rules for what law will govern torts and other similar claims, similar to torts. So it's a broader concept of torts.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Here.
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions. First, let me say I really, really support this effort. And I just wanted to point out for people on the committee, this is probably seems very abstract and complex, but I'll tell you it's a real issue. I've represented business clients over the years who, in the modern world with the way international commerce happens, we see cases all the time now where multiple states' interests could be involved in a lawsuit. And I have had clients over the years have to pay many, many thousands of dollars for an analysis about just which state's law is likely to apply to the case. And I'm always uncomfortable when we have to do that because, as the witnesses have explained, this kind of analysis is very squishy and it's very hard to get any predictability out of it. And so I guess in that respect, I'm sorry to see this bill because there are going to be fewer legal fees paid as a result of it. But I think it's very important. And I guess my questions are not about any of the substantive rules developed because there are too many of them in there to really get into, but I'd like to know more about the process that went into this. It's obviously a significant body of work, and I would just like to hear more about whether this was, I hope it's a consensus work. Were there sharp disagreements in the work groups about what the directions we ought to go? I guess a related question would be, I believe counsel said we're the second state to codify conflicts rules. Do you see any downside to being at the leading edge of this? And I guess a final question would be, given that we did this with contracts rules several years ago, have there been any problems that arose out of that? Are there any unintended consequences we saw from codifying contracts rules that we should be thinking of as we do this?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrett, these are very good questions. First, the process. Professor Dobbins mentioned earlier the part of the composition of the work group. It included one retired Justice of the Supreme Court, one Court of Appeals judge, and one trial judge, but also five attorneys of different persuasions and two law professors. So it's a pretty diverse group. We work on this for about a year and a half, taking advantage of my experience and my summaries of the case law. We went through 12 drafts, So we started with something. We debated every single line. We have some very sharp attorneys and judges on the committee. They, you know, they shut down a lot of things. We changed it. In the end, after 12 drafts, we came to you. So it has been thoroughly discussed, and it was unanimously adopted by the working group and the Oregon Law Commission as a whole. We are the second state to codify this. You may wonder which was the first state. Well, it happened that it was the state of Louisiana, which has a very rich experience in codification. Again, I was the drafter of what became the codification of conflicts law for Louisiana back in 1991. One may wonder, how has that worked? Someone else did a study of what the courts were doing before the codification of 91 and what we're doing afterwards. Before the codification, the reversal rate of lower court opinions by Court of Appeals was 75%. In other words, the lower courts were getting it wrong all the time. After the codification, the reversal rate went down to 25%, which here's an example of more predictability. Now, with regard to the Oregon statute for contracts, it has been working beautifully. We have not identified any problems. And in fact, in drafting this statute, we tried to use parallel language whenever we could, and so on, so that the two can coexist very well together.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just sort of a follow-up to both Representative Barton and Garrett's questions. You've described who was involved, but I guess my question is, and I have healthy skepticism any time we codify a body of law like this. It just makes my stomach hurt, but that's okay. What I understand the who, and I understand, but I guess I need a little bit clearer picture of the what and where. Where did, I mean, it's all wonderful to have great minds in a room together, but why and how did you decide on these particular pieces of law? You've indicated that the second restatement, I'm getting the sense, and from reading through this, there's very little of that survived into this body of work. So where did this come from? And I guess that's
okay.
My biggest concern.
Very good question, Representative Stigler. What we did is we looked at what American courts doing in general. You might say, why did you go beyond Oregon? Well, we started, of course, with Oregon law, but we don't have enough cases, at least appellate cases, from which cover every possibility. And furthermore, what Oregon courts have done is simply to adopt, you know, a combination actually of several approaches from interest analysis, the restatement second, and so on. Over the years, they have shifted from the one to the other. So there wasn't enough to go by if we were to limit ourselves to Oregon cases only, primarily because there haven't been cases of every category. So instead of looking only at Oregon cases, we looked at what American courts are doing in the last 40 years. So what we try to do is to codify the results of those cases. So this is the origin of this bill. It's not coming from the sky, from my head or anything. We simply codify the experience of American courts over the last 40 years.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
In that vein, then, Professor Erding, because I'm assuming that as you assessed this broad base of case law, that you came across a variety of approaches to dealing with different situations. In other words, conflicts in the conflicts. I mean, so how did you sort through and make a decision as to, you know, what should be codified in Oregon statutes? I mean, what was your weighing and balancing process?
It was,
you don't have to get into the minutiae,
sure,
but
right,
in general.
Yeah. Well, essentially, we go with the majority, and if there is no clear majority, we don't propose a rule. You know, for example, take the situation where both parties are domiciled in one state or residing in one state, mm-hmm. and they have the accident in the other state. Well, it turns out that if you take only Supreme Court cases, state Supreme Court right. cases in the gotcha. 50 states, we have in about 87% of the cases deciding one way.
Okay.
And others are deciding the different way, but those are old cases that are discredited or overruled. So really, it's almost 95% majority. Now, you might say, if courts are reaching the same result, why codify the law? You know, why let them do it? Well, the problem with that is that, first of all, these courts are using a lot of different rationales. And secondly, they because there is no rule that they are obliged to follow, they have to reinvent the wheel in every case. And for the attorney, that means they have to argue under all of these malleable theories and so on. So what we have done, therefore, is to take the majority results and put them into the form of a black letter rule, sometimes with escapes, because we recognize there may be cases that don't quite fit the mold. So that was our method, essentially codifying the results of the vast majority of American cases.
Follow up, final. And you indicated that in those areas where there didn't seem to be consensus or there wasn't a majority
right.
rule, so to speak,
that right. it
could be identified, you didn't codify.
Well, we didn't provide an explicit rule that tells the court exactly what law to apply. We have Section 9, which is a little right. like the restatement. And that's where the difficult cases go.
Okay.
For example, when the dispute is not between the injured party and the party who caused the injury, but is rather between joint tortfeasors, other people involved,
right.
third parties. Those are far more complicated cases, and American courts are lost, you know. So we didn't, we don't tell them exactly what to do there. We say, look at these factors and these policies and so on. So we only provide black letter rules when we are certain that the result has been tested over the years. If it's not tested, we leave the flexibility of a restatement type of method.
So you identified those areas then where
correct.
There maybe is a general broad base of criteria to
yes, ma'am.
To apply
yes.
in those.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
okay. Thank you.
Mr. Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor, this is my third session on this committee, and we're always the toughest decisions we have is in tort and liability. You said you had a lot of people working on this. Did you have professionals from the manufacturing or the medical profession representation on your task force?
Not directly, but there is a process of public comment and invitation. We did have a couple of times. I remember one gentleman showed up from the insurance industry, for example. He came to several meetings, make some very good comments. You know.
So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I might just add in on that point, and Representative Wisnett, and really this is directed to a lot of the questions that the committee has directed this direction. The process that took place in the work group at the Law Commission was really sort of intended to flesh out these areas in which either it makes a lot of sense to codify the law because this is simply the way that it seems to be working on a regular basis, but by codification we make sure that courts and litigants get to that place more quickly, and then by contrast to identify those areas in this general topic area where there's not as much consensus, where maybe there's some way to explain to the courts, here's what the general rule has been in the past so that we don't need to reinvent the wheel. But that process of identifying those areas of concern comes through the work of these work groups, which are really consensus-driven groups. And even though we didn't have specific representatives of manufacturers, several of the attorneys that participated on the work groups have represented defendants in cases that would be affected by these on a regular level, and they were, you know, very active in the process of commenting on which categories should or should not fall within some of the presumptions, for instance.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I don't know for whom this is a better question for. What role do you think the legislature should play in reviewing this? And there's several sub-questions I could use to get at that a little bit. One might be, to what degree of rigor did the Senate apply itself and the Senate Judiciary Committee apply itself? And maybe one measurement of that might be how many, if any, amendments were made on the Senate side. Is there anything that has been done to this piece of legislation in the legislature, or was everything done on the Law Commission side? And if that's the case, is our best posture merely to say thank you and ask some questions so that we have done our duty, or is there some other level of rigor we should apply?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, at the Senate Judiciary Committee, we had a similar hearing. It was briefer because their agenda was longer.
Let me explain why. we have four attorneys. That's why.
So much better.
They only have two.
I don't know if it had anything to do with the fact that the one commissioner is also a member of that committee. But generally, you know, the questions were not as incisive as here. And as with regard to the Senate floor, it passed without amendments. So apparently the Senate is very happy with this bill. As to what kind of rigor I expect from you, my personal position is the more the better. I mean, I'm not claiming that you should rubber stamp the bill. And in fact, I would offer myself at your convenience individually later on. If you have specific concerns, you know, I would be glad to sit with you as long as you need me to.
Representative Smith, one of the things that the Law Commission really makes an effort to do is when there are policy choices that are set out in statutes, we really try and flag those in the accompanying reports. And so there are mentions throughout the accompanying report here that talk about places where the committee decided to leave out categories or to place categories in them. Obviously, to the degree that the committee believes that, or to the degree that the entire assembly believes that there's different overall policy choices that could be made, that's obviously a very good place for the committee to focus in on. At the same time, to the degree that the project was prompted by an effort to say, there are things that the courts are doing, we should try and make that clear that this is how things are working so that everybody can kind of recognize that from the beginning of a case rather than having to litigate it out. That's really what this is attempted to do. So obviously, you know, if there's places that the committee believes that departure is warranted as a policy matter, you know, absolutely. The purpose of this particular approach was to try and codify what is happening to a substantial degree.
Representative Barton, would you like to have this held over until you could get some answers?
Yeah, yes, please. I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any further questions today?
Just a comment. I think it's amazing that the training of different people and how some minds gravitate that this becomes a person's life. And
Representative is putting his hat in the ring to be the next member of the Law Commission.
Put it on your hand.
I didn't mean that. I actually have a question for you, because on this committee, we have golfers, we have anchors, we have people who play bridge, we have a member who I happen to know does a lot of reading on the Founding Fathers. What do you do for a hobby or recreation?
And if you answer, do this, then you're really in trouble.
Well, that's a very good question for which I don't have a good answer.
It's still a fact, not a difference.
That's it.
For
thank you, Dave.
Thank you,
Professor.
Thanks.
We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 561. Do we have a date to move that over? We just moved it. We just put it in line somewhere. Okay. And go back and open a work session on Senate Bill 558.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I move Senate Bill 558 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 558 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krueger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiglitz.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitmer?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries.
Hint, hint.
It has consent counter potential, Mr. Chair.
Which one is that we just passed?
Oh.
That's the articles, the first articles, 1 and 7.
No.
Yeah, he's ready for it.
Garrett's good. I'll give you my phone. Garrett's good.
That sounds like consent counter material to me, too.
Okay. No, no, no.
And open a, close that here. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 562.
Work session.
I'm sorry, work session. 562.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I move Senate Bill 562 to the floor to do pass the recommendation.
Representative Wisnam moves Senate Bill 562 to the floor to do pass. Further discussion, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Cleary?
I think so, yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Levin?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries.
Consent
calendar.
Consent, or you want to?
It's an easy one. Okay. You want to do that or consent? Your choice.
What?
Oh, it can, I don't care what it can be.
I move consent calendar.
Yeah.
Put that one on the consent calendar. And
sounds good to me.
We will carry over 561, Senate Bill 561, until May 14th.
I can't wait.
Danger.